Good morning and welcome to Central Standard Friday. I'm Monroe Dodd. Irishness will be a hard thing to miss this weekend. If you're driving around Midtown on Sunday, St. Patrick's Day, some streets will be blocked and others will be filled with cars and revelers. From Westport to the Plaza and in a lot of other entertainment districts, you'll see much of the same. TV, the newspapers, and websites about Kansas City will have accounts of Irish events. That's because we have one of the country's bigger St. Patrick's Day celebrations, one that's been going on in its current incarnation for four decades. But the Irish influence on Kansas City goes back farther, much farther. It began after the Civil War, moved into the police department, the packing houses, the railroad yards, and politics, and eventually into every walk of Kansas City's life. Today, we'll be talking with someone whose family business goes back more than a century and a quarter, and Irishness runs throughout all those 125 years. Kerry Brown operates Brown's Market at 33rd in Pennsylvania and is deeply involved in many things Irish in Kansas City. Kerry, welcome to Central Standard Friday.
Good morning, Monroe. Thanks for having me here.
And later, we'll visit with someone who's a part of one of the many Irish festivals that go on in the Kansas City area. This weekend, Bob Reeder will be playing in Weston. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Monroe. How are you doing?
Just fine, thanks. First, Kerry Brown, what makes this celebration so popular, especially in Kansas City?
Kansas City loves to celebrate any event, but I think our heritage and our culture is so great, and this time of year is a super time to bring it out in every aspect, in the music, in the dancing, the language. It's a great reason to celebrate and get together and share with your friends and family.
St. Patrick couldn't have picked a finer time to run the snakes out of Ireland than just before spring dawns, could he?
It's perfect.
The estimates of Irish descendants in our area go as high as a quarter million. Was there a wave of Irish immigration to Kansas City, and when did that happen?
There's been many waves throughout the time. The potato famine back in the mid-1800s, right after the Civil War, was a big one because there was nothing to eat. There was no way to survive. So the ships of people just came in droves. And Kansas City was a natural place to settle because when you look at the lay of the land, my relatives who come from Ireland look and go, well, I don't know why you come to Ireland. It looks just like that here with the rolling hills and green and the farmland. It's a perfect settlement for Irish who long for home. And a lot started on the East Coast, but as they worked their way through, they called them over and said, this is where we belong. This is a good fit for us.
And they kept a lot of their culture, their ethnicity, their heritage, and their food.
Exactly. Because imagine leaving home, and it's not like now where you have a cell phone and know you can contact them and go back. They left and knew they left that life forever. So some of them wanted to say goodbye and wanted no part of it, and that's why they dropped it. But other ones were willing to cling on to any part of it to remember their family and all. So I think food is a natural thing, and it's what they knew. So food has so many sentiments for all of us. So when they were away they could bring it here and have a taste of home and family, I think was very important.
Immigrants move away for a bunch of reasons, but it's usually because something's not right in the home country. They can't bear it there anymore, and they move to a place because something draws them there. In Kansas City, there were jobs, I know, in the railroads, the packing houses, various places. What made Kansas City such a lure for so many Irish in the late 1800s?
I think exactly that there were jobs in a lot of other places there weren't. Irish got known to be great stonemasons because when you look in Ireland, there's rows and rows of little stone walls. And that in Kansas City, look at our great stonework around the city. Most of that, the whole foundation for this city was laid by those great Irish stonemasons. So that was a big part of reasons why they came here. Again, the farming, so the railroad work. There were so many perfect jobs that they were already trained in.
I know that a guy named Father Bernard Donnelly, one of the biggest priests in our history, played a big role in making sure Irish came to Kansas City. Is that right?
He did. I mean, imagine the difference one man can make that he welcomed people from the East Coast somehow, again, without technology of today, got the word back that this is the place to be, and he found a way to bring families over. At that time, he needed sponsors, so he'd set up people with sponsors so they were able to come over. And a big part of the reason we have so many Irish in Kansas City is because of the amazing work he did in reaching out to that community.
Your own family traces itself back to County Kerry?
County Kerry. Or the original ones who opened our store were from the Stoll. And my mom's family is also from County Kerry. And then My grandfather is from Knocknagashal, County Kerry, and we're lucky to have most of our family still over there, so we're able to go. And when you go there and see the way it's set up, you come back and go, oh, that's why they did this way, because it's just how they knew, the look of the building, everything they do.
Yeah, this is retailing there was duplicated by retailing here.
Exactly. Even the design of the store, when you drive through Limerick or something, it's like, oh, that looks just like our store. So they came by it naturally.
Now, what about the design? This is fascinating. Do you see that reminds you of 33rd in Pennsylvania?
Well, and I don't know enough about architecture other than when I went there, it's like the same layout, the same little porch on the front, the same shape windows that is all over Listowel and Tralee and in that area.
Now, when your parents started, your multi-great-grandparents started the store at 27th and Jefferson in 1887, is that right?
In the front of their home, more like a general store.
And that address is now part of the northwest part of Pin Valley Park, I believe. It's been pretty well scraped away by the Parks and Boulevard. Is that why in 1901 they moved to 33rd in Pennsylvania to make way for that development of the parks?
Well, two reasons from what we understand. They built the St. Joseph's Orphanage there, so they needed the land for that. And also they just needed more space. It was in the front of their home. And they were adventurous people when you think back that it was on the outskirts of town. They were immigrants, and at that time immigrants weren't well respected or loved or given jobs. But they took that type of adventure to go outside of town on 33rd Street and built a good-sized structure, and then they lived above it. And a couple years later built another building, and a couple years later another. So and back at the time, it was probably dust roads and horses and carriages. So it wasn't like we have now, but I admire them. That was an amazing thing they did.
Today we call that area Midtown, but from the 1880s until the early 1900s, that was on the outskirts and in some cases beyond the city limit.
Yeah.
So that is a bit of interest. In Kansas City history, a lot of attention is paid to the Irish in the West Bottoms, in the First Ward, where Jim Pendergast ruled the day and was the ward boss and had a tavern and so forth. And his son, his brother Tom sprang from there and so forth. But though that wasn't the only Irish enclave, I know there was another factional leader named Joseph Shannon, the head of the Rabbits, and one named Casimir Welch, who despite his first name was in fact Irish, who had various Irish enclaves around town. Was the area where your parents started their store, sort of on the west side of what's now Midtown, was that an Irish enclave? Were those Irish enclaves then too?
Yeah, that was the Kerry Patch, which I always grew up feeling proud of, as my name is Kerry. And so a lot of settlers from County Kerry, Ireland, went in there in Coleman Highlands and Roanoke. And Redemptorist Church was a huge base for all of them, again, built by the stonemasons from Ireland. So it was kind of something that kept it together. And probably back in the day, we think there was Redemptorist Church and Browns, and then the community kind of built around that.
The church is a key part of Irish community building in those days, wasn't it?
Very much, yeah. Because, and it still is. We had a Gaelic Mass there the other day where the community comes around and celebrates, again, part of the heritage. And you see people that have moved to all parts of the city and even region, but come back for that, for a way to come back to their old church and celebrate their traditional heritage.
That had to be renewed, though, the Gaelic Mass. It hasn't been going on for a century and a quarter at that church, has it?
No, we just started that back up about 20 years ago to kind of bring back some of the old heritage and culture to the neighborhood.
Very interesting. Why was it ever dropped, if it was ever dropped, or was it ever started before then?
I don't know if it was ever started. The Irish, back in that generation, like my grandfather, he wouldn't speak Irish to me and wouldn't talk about a lot of the Irish because they were so suppressed, and they couldn't even learn it in school for a long time.
Suppressed back in the old country
back
by the British.
Back in Ireland, yeah. Right. And the British came in and, there were so many things they stopped them, but the language was a big part of it. So when I was growing up, my aunts in Ireland are teachers, so they would only write us letters in Irish, and it was such a big thing to make sure that this generation hung on to it.
You're listening to Central Standard Friday on KCUR. I'm Monroe Dodd, here today with Kerry Brown and Bob Reeder. Today, we're 2 days before St. Patrick's Day, and we're talking about the Irish in Kansas City and its environs. Our guests are, as I said, Kerry Brown and the owner of Brown's Market, and Bob Reeder, whom we'll be speaking to in just a while. Things weren't perfectly smooth for the Irish here in Kansas City when they came as immigrants. Immigrant groups tend to be distrusted by the existing groups, no matter.
Yes.
And when they're new and they come in force and they have a culture that sticks together, that makes it even more so. Tell us about some of the early Irish cultural things and how they might have been muted over the years, only to come back.
It's interesting. We have a sign hanging in our store: "No Irish need apply. Help wanted. No Irish need apply."
Yeah.
And you think of that now because Irish is, you know, so in, and everybody wants to claim Irishness. But back then, how people would either change their name, or that even the fact that these tradespeople who were so talented weren't wanted just because of being Irish. So that's just an amazing thing for me to think about.
And perhaps as a result of that, the Irish banded together and became one of the most important political forces in Kansas City history.
Exactly. I think that separation from the rest of the community made them stick together and be stronger, and still are today.
Besides the church, what other parts of people's surroundings, the Irish surroundings in the late 1800s, would have been community areas? Taverns were one, I believe. What about playing fields? Were there sports that they indulged in?
Down, you mentioned Penn Valley Park. That was just an open field then. That was a big gathering place for one. In the summer, there was no air conditioning, so they'd gather around the water there, and they'd play music, play sports. That was a big thing in any open fields, a way to get together and, again, to celebrate their common loves.
Well, before we go on anymore, I think we ought to introduce Bob Reeder once again. Bob, good morning, and thanks for being with us.
Good morning, and thank you for having me on.
And we have some recordings of his music here. Bob's also brought his instrument, but in addition, I think he brought a CD or a thumb drive. So let's start with the first, which is to help start this weekend off, Paddy's Green Shamrock Shore.
From Derry Kay we sailed away on the 23rd of May. We were boarded by a pleasant crew bound for America. Fresh water there, now we did take on 5,000 gallons or more. In case we'd run short, going to New York, far away from the Shamrock Shore. So fare thee well, sweet Liza dear, and likewise to Derry town. And twice farewell to my comrades all that dwell on that saint ground. If fortune should ever follow me, oh, and I would have money in store, I'd go back and I'd wed the wee lass that I left on Paddy's Green Shamrock Shore.
Bob Reeder, that's really neat. Is that an ancient song or one you did?
Well, actually, the song is not that old, but of course it refers to the immigration of Ireland from the 40s to the present day, and people still leaving Ireland, you know. But no, it's they boarded coffin ships in the old days, as they called them, because anywhere from a third to half of the people would perish on the way to America. The Irish during the potato famine period were so undernourished that they just couldn't make the trip. So it's really amazing to me that we have all survived coming all the way from that. And when you consider the number of people that died just to get to America, it's you have to thank your stars for that.
Yes, you mentioned in the song the words talk about the laying on of water. Simply fresh water. You couldn't throw a bucket over the side and drink, or you'd
not
have salt water.
No.
And
not unless you wanted to die. Yeah,
it is amazing that people survived. What did the trip? How many weeks did a trip like that take? Do you know?
It took anywhere from 3 to 6 weeks sometimes, I think, to get over. So it was quite a. It was, you know, anywhere from depends on the route that they would take, and of course what ship they were on. Some ships, there were some steamships in those days, and. Later on, and and that would get over a lot quicker, of course. But when they first came over, it was a pretty long journey.
That's part of the thing. We tend to look at the past, I think, through the prism of the current life, and you think, oh, well, they must have all boarded the QE2 with stabilizers and things and waiters and big meals and things each night. Instead, these were much smaller craft. And if they were lucky enough to be a steam craft, they might make a little bit better time than a sailing craft. There's smoke, there's flame, there's the danger of fire, it's a nasty business going across the ocean.
Yes, it is. I've been on that ocean.
Yeah. So all of us who trace our lineage back to immigrants had to endure that. But the Irish in the late 1800s came over in force and endured quite a bit of that. That's interesting. Great song. We'll come back with some more songs, Bob, in a while. Carrie, if I've asked you this question, please forgive me already, but when these Irish immigrants were coming to New York and then later through other cities and winding up in Kansas City, were they eating foods from the old sod, or were they just eating whatever could be found?
I think a lot new fishing, because there's so much of Ireland is covered in water between the lakes within it and the ocean around it. So that's why the ones that settled on the East Coast were comfortable there, and the ones that came further in started doing some of the planting. The corned beef that everybody thinks of as so Irish now isn't something you'd ever find in Ireland, but they had beef and they didn't have a way to preserve it, so they did know how to pickle things from back home in Ireland. So they'd build sheds to pickle their meat, and so the corned beef is more about the immigration to America in a way, and so it's why we celebrate it now is more traditional of that, of our ancestors that came here.
I see. So it was developed by Irish descendants, but done so in America as a preservative. What then, at Brown's Market, what are some dishes that are authentic to Ireland?
Bangers and mash is a real common one. Bangers is an Irish sausage that's delicious, and we serve it at our Irish breakfast as well. But it's great with mashed potatoes and a little gravy. Root vegetables are the source of all things Irish. So every meal has, two or three good root vegetables. And that's potatoes and carrots and parsnips and turnips and a lot of veggies. We have Ed Brown's, one of our favorites, is shepherd's pie. And we do that with ground beef and lots of vegetables and more potatoes. Every good Irish dish has potatoes. Also, the breads are real important because a lot of times that's all they could afford to make. Even my grandmother here used to say that when there was no money for meat and other things, there was always bread. And so today I brought some Irish soda bread, and that's a real traditional thing. Soda bread is used in Ireland and bread just because it's such a humid climate they can't do the yeast. Mm. So almost any Irish bread is a soda bread.
Ah, okay. And then there's the matter of drink. Guinness, we know about.
Indeed.
What about other drinks that are actually Irish as opposed to green beer?
Yes, real. Smittix is another popular one that just has been over a couple years, and a lot of people's like, I never need to go back to Ireland. They have Smittix here now.
So for those of us who are looking at the word and not knowing how to pronounce it, would look like Smithwick,
I believe. Smithwick, yeah. That's how most people say it. And Magners just started coming out a couple years ago. That's a cider that's really big in Ireland. And a man from Ireland came in a couple years ago when he saw it and actually wept. Because he was like, oh, my gosh, the taste of home. And again, it's that memory of a flavor. And Bailey's is the number one selling drink in the world. Mm-hmm. So that's, and of course, Jameson. We have Irish whiskey tastings at our store all the time. And Jameson has a full range now. Powers and Patties and all the other different Redbreast. Middleton is a higher-end Jameson that have suddenly come over. There's a lot more Irish whiskeys than ever right now.
In the 19th century, I know that some ethnic groups, Poles and others in places like Chicago, could carry home a pail of beer or something from a market. Would your ancestors' market have vended beer, or what would they have done?
We found some of our ancestors' pails, so we know that they had it. My grandfather from Knocknagashal opened a pub before he started working at Brown's with his wife, Brown. So we're not sure if the pails came from the pub or they had a way of taking care of it right at Brown's.
Where was the pub?
Down on by Crown Royal Liquor or Southwest Boulevard, by Boulevard Brewing Company.
Mm-hmm. Down at Southwest Boulevard in Summit, that vicinity, yes.
Yes, exactly. And we found that out from the records that came in from Ellis Island. And by the way, the first immigrant to Ellis Island, you probably know this, was a little 16-year-old girl, Annie Moore, from Ireland. So that's how far the Irish come back, the first one into Ellis Island.
Your umpty great grandparents were Edward Flavin? Flavin?
Flavin, we say it here, Flavin in Ireland. Ed and Mary Dillon Flavin opened the store.
That is so great. And you have then, since then, developed it into more of an Irish-themed store in your time.
Right. It's kind of, I think it's maintained itself for 126 years because we kind of have adapted through the years to what's needed and what people are looking for, and because a lot more is available. Like, they were able to get the embroidered lace from their relatives or the hand-knit sweaters from their relatives, but now once importing has gotten a lot bigger, we're able to bring in a lot more.
So for many decades, Brown's Market was a standard grocery, well, a general purpose grocery store or just store?
Grocery store, meat market, but always had some dry goods too.
Well, we have a caller, and if you'd like to join us, you can call us at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888 to talk about any and or all things Irish. And our first caller is Frank from Kansas City. Good morning, Frank.
Good morning. How are you guys doing?
Good morning.
We are great.
Okay. I respect you, first of all. Now, I just wanted to throw in a quick comment about the Irish history. You know, it's strange, I guess, in a way, as an African-American, I've been accepted into the Irish community in that there is a bar in Westport, and I go to numerous of times, and not thinking of the name, but by the same token, I've gone to the bar for several years, and the drinks that they give me, they're good. And I've gone to several of the parades, and I just want to say they accepted me as a brother. Had me singing Irish songs. I didn't know what I was singing, but they were Irish songs. And the parades, I try not to miss the parades. I've missed a few. So I'm just saying the Irish have a very good legacy, and I appreciate them, and they've accepted me as a brother. I'm brown-skinned, but by the same token, they got me singing Irish songs.
Do you remember what song it was you were singing? Could you give us some words?
I don't know. I don't even know what the song was, but I was singing it, and they said, okay, brother.
Frank, that's a great story. Thanks so much for calling and sharing with us.
Okay, you guys have a nice day, and I'll sit back and listen.
Right, bye-bye.
Is it possible that the Irish, because they had themselves met such intolerance over time on the island and in America, might... this is speculation, might be more accepting.
That's exactly right. The Irish were so oppressed in their own homeland that when they came to America, they really didn't discriminate in any way at all. Actually, there's a lot of records of slaves and Irish working right alongside of each other. The Irish were expendable, and a slave in the days before the Civil War was a commodity. So your Irish did a lot of the very, very dirty jobs, like digging the canal down in New Orleans and working on the docks in Mobile Bay and places like that. So, the slaves and the Irish exchanged a lot of culture, and there's even some songs that I sing that explain that exchange.
Well, that's great, and it's so great to hear from Frank on that. We're going to be back after a brief break here to talk more about the Irish and about St. Patrick's Day in Kansas City with our guests, Kerry Brown and Bob Reeder. Right now you're listening to Central Standard Friday on KCUR. Thank you. Central Standard Friday here at the beginning of the St. Patrick's Day weekend. I'm Munro Dodd. Our guests today are Carrie Brown of Brown's Market and Bob Reeder, a musician who performs many things Irish. St. Patrick's Day and weekend have for decades now been a big deal in Kansas City, but the Irish influence here goes way back to the 1800s. We're talking about that history today, the nearby history and the long-ago history. And you can call us and ask questions of our guests by calling 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Carrie Brown, the big festival this weekend dates in its current incarnation back to 1973. Can you tell us how it began and how it's evolved over the years?
I think it began like all great Irish things. A couple of Irishmen sitting at a bar going, I got an idea. And then that's where it went. They were down at Italian Gardens downtown. Pat O'Neill Sr., Mike Murphy went and said, let's have a parade. And they put a signboard on. And the front of the signboard was start of the parade. And the back of the signboard was end of the parade. And now, if you ask people, every single person in Kansas City was in that original parade. But there was just the three of them in Italian Gardens of all places. And talk about the different ethnic groups working together. I think that says it all.
Scholars of the beginning of that parade, and one of them would be Mike Murphy, said that it went about a block and a half. They actually did walkaways, and he called it the world's shortest and worst parade.
He was so proud. Yeah.
I think it was the staggering that probably
made it the worst. It, like all Irish stories, it got embellished a bit, too, through the years.
But it needs no embellishing that the thing became huge in a very short order. I remember by the late 70s and early 80s, there were people all over the place watching it as it went down Grand Avenue and once through Westport. And
We did have a few different moves, and now we're in Broadway, starting at 33rd Street and heading into Westport. And that seems to be a great fit because it is starting right in Carey Patch, like we were talking about. But people like Freddie Wersch, who was on the committee. He was the committee for, I think, 20 years, and there was some of those early workers who gave it their all year after year, and that's why it was able to come into such a big parade. This year we're celebrating our 41st, which is amazing, and it's actually going to be the second biggest in the country on St. Patrick's Day.
And that's Sunday. And what time will the parade start?
At 11 o'clock, and no one should be concerned at all about the little bit of moisture because it's going to be a true Irish day. And when we say we want to embrace our heritage, that little bit of soft day is just what we need.
You have to take the weather with it,
exactly.
That's for sure.
And it starts where?
It starts at 11 o'clock on 33rd and Broadway, right in front of Redemptress Church, and heads north on Broadway to Westport.
South on Broadway to Westport. All right, and then after, and I suppose Westport will be open for business.
Yes, there will be partying all along the route, and Westport is one of our major sponsors, and we're grateful to them for always welcoming us.
And Brown's Market is open for business that day?
Brown's Market is open at 7 o'clock to serve a traditional Irish breakfast and have great music and dancers and bagpipers, and we serve all day through lunch.
Let's go back to the old side just a second for a question from Howard in Overland Park. Good morning, Howard.
Hello, everyone.
Hi.
I'm sure you remember the name Bernadette Devlin. Bernadette Devlin was a world-famous Northern Ireland activist. And I heard her speak here at UMKC in 1970. And the next morning, the Kansas City Star on the front page, it said fire in those Irish eyes. But I'd like to know, do you know whatever became of Bernadette Devlin? And secondly, what's the relationship between Northern Ireland and England these days? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
I could talk a little bit about the North. I mean, things are definitely have changed a lot, and it's a lot more peacekeeping. My niece was able to go over there and study for a semester, and it was a whole different place. We grew up thinking of the North and Belfast, and that's not a place. But now it is celebrating peace and enjoying that.
Well, I think many thanks to Senator Mitchell for going over and helping to draft the Good Friday Agreement. Of course, put an end to a lot of conflict there. And, of course, we don't want anybody getting killed over there anymore. And it's all under the European Union now, both with England and with Ireland, so maybe we'll come together someday. We hope to see an autonomous Ireland.
The primary part of Ireland is uses the Irish pound for its currency. Is that right? Or does it use the euro? Does Erin itself use the euro or the Irish pound these days?
They use the euro.
And then the north then still has the English pound.
That's right. Okay. Yeah, the British decided that they would join the EU, but they decided that that which defines a country is its money, and that's why they never went on the euro.
Okay. Let's go now to another caller, Carrie in Waldo. Good morning, Carrie.
Good morning. Great show. I think everybody knows about the Irish and the potato famine, but I've done genealogy on my family tree, and most of my family was here before the American Revolution, and one of them came over as a 14-year-old boy in the 1760s, served in the Revolution, was awarded a land grant in Tennessee, and that kind of got our family kick-started. So I wanted to know if there's been much research or interest in learning about the Irish before the potato famine, because they were a huge part of the immigration from the very beginning of the settlement of this country.
The Protestant Irish helped to blaze trails through Pennsylvania and, of course, the eastern United States. And, of course, that was due to the fact that, being Protestant, it was England that was backing a lot of the expeditions over here in the early, actually in the 1700s. And so, you know, it goes back that far as immigration, but mostly Protestants to begin with, and then later on Catholics started coming over.
And so, okay. I'm sorry, go ahead.
And if you want to learn more, I don't know if you've heard of Michael O'Loughlin. He's written so many books about Irish genealogy coming to Kansas City, and you can look it up online, Irish Roots Cafe. And he's also interviewed a lot of old Kansas City Irish and historians and has a lot of it documented. That's a great source to find more information.
Yeah, and the Irish Cultural Center down in Union Station is wonderful.
That's exactly what I was going to say, too, because Barb Scanlon down there, we had a party down there just
treasure.
Last night. Yeah.
Okay. And don't get her talking because she won't shut up.
But it's all worth hearing.
Yeah, she's full of Irish, isn't she?
What do you expect?
Thanks so much for your call. We have Bob Reeder with it. He's been talking a little bit about history, but he can also talk some about, he can also sing some. In fact, he can sing quite a bit. We have some of his songs on recording here. And the next one up we'll play a bit of is Minstrel Boy.
Hey, how many people here saw that movie, The Man Who Would Be King? It was a Rudyard Kipling novel, which was turned into a movie with Sean Connery and Michael Caine. This is the song that they sang in there. It's called The Minstrel Boy.
Great rendition again there, Bob. Let's go now to Dan in Kansas City. Dan, good morning. Dan, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead with your question or comment.
I have a question for Bob.
Yes, Dan.
Would you pick us up some green paint?
I'll definitely do that. How much do you want?
And where do I want it?
Exactly.
Actually, I'm going to hand this over to Linda Inlow.
Okay. She's the president of the Harp and Shamrock Club.
Yes, which, good.
Good morning, Linda.
Good morning, folks. What a great show.
Oh, thanks.
Just wondering if you're stopping by for a spot of tea later.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, we want to thank you for being part of Harp and Shamrock all these years.
Well, thank you very much. It's good to be part of that. We have a charity called the Harp and Shamrock Club, and we raise money for Children's Mercy Hospital for hearing aids for kids over there at the Speech and Hearing Clinic. And we've been doing it for a very long time now.
16 years.
16, yeah. And,
yeah.
And we put well over 200 kids in hearing aids over there and supplied over one-third of all the hearing aids that are given out over there. So.
What a good cause.
Yeah, we can't think of a better thing to do than let kids hear great Irish music.
Yeah, then they give that back the hearing aid.
Okay, Linda and Dan, thanks so much for calling.
Yep, bye-bye. See you later.
Bob, you've been playing at O'Malley's 1842 Pub in Weston for a while now and other venues.
Yeah, just sort of getting started up there. First, I did their grand opening 25 years ago, and I'm hoping the gig will last. That's all.
Weston does not have is not historically have a big Irish population, but it has latched on to things Irish in a big way over the years.
There's a few Irishmen that live up there to begin with. In those early days of 1842, when the brewery was established there, Weston was the fifth largest city west of the Mississippi. There were over 5,000 people living and working there. There were four furniture factories going around the clock. It was the last outpost of humanity before you stepped out onto the Oregon and California trails. It was quite a place. The river was down at the end of the town in the old days, and in 1867, there was an earthquake. The Humboldt Fault in Kansas gave way, and it caused the river to settle over where it was, where it is right now, over by Fort Leavenworth. An interesting side note about that, the man who did all the survey work on the Missouri River and the floodplain was a man by the name of Robert E. Lee, and he has his descendants settled in Weston, as well as Lincoln's first girlfriend, Mary Vineyard, the other Mary, I guess you could call her.
Now, O'Malley's Irish Pub has many a level with many a group playing on those levels. Is that, am I correct?
Oh, yes, we have two main cellars for music. We have a middle cellar. There's actually four cellars that are open to the public. There's actually five cellars on the property. We've never really found a fifth cellar, and we usually go looking for that right around 3 o'clock in the morning. So.
And these were cellars that were originally filled with beer to keep it cool?
That's exactly right. It's the first place that lager beer was brewed in the United States, and, of course, lager refers to a word in German, lagern, which means to store. The beer is usually made with what they call bottom fermenting. And those cellars up there were originally for refrigeration. The ice was cut out of the river and dragged into the ice house, stored, and this is how they got the temperature down. In the old days, they didn't have refrigeration, so what they had to do was to dig a hole and get as cool as they could do it, and they did it with ice as well. And so the beer was stored for a certain period of time, and John Georgian, who was the German brewmaster there, saw a great opportunity that people might, as they headed out on the Oregon and California trails, that they might want to take a six-pack to go. So, you know.
Weston, one of many of the cities like Kansas City and its environs that make quite a thing out of Irishness and St. Patrick's Day. I can think of Shawnee, North Kansas City. There are others, probably too numerous to mention, but I know they've eluded my memory. So it's interesting why you can turn around and not be very far from an Irish, a hooli of some sort. Is that the right word? On the weekend to come. You're listening to Central Standard Friday on KCUR. I'm Monroe Dodd. Let's go to another caller, Mary Jean in Overland Park. Good morning, Mary Jean.
Good morning. I've so enjoyed the show so far. I want to say hello to Carrie. And
hi, Mary
Hi. Just wanted to add that my mother's family, years ago, my mother would talk about trading at Brown's. And that's where their family went for their goods. And she always thought very highly of it. And then we were lucky enough to go to school with the Brown girls. And every time you go in there, Carrie and John make you feel so welcomed, and it's warm and inviting, as if you just came into their living room and you're sitting down and having a chat with them, and it's just wonderful.
Well,
and
thank
a friend
you, Mary
of
Jean.
Oh, you're welcome. Do you remember Sorka that came
yes,
and worked for you?
From Ireland.
Yes. She's a woman that was married a friend of ours, and you could tell she was yearning for Ireland, so we tried to connect her with Carrie and John, and I think it made all the difference for her feeling at home in Kansas City. And I think Brown's is one of the gems on our city. It's just, it is the go-to place to welcome people in.
Well, thank you, Mary Jean.
You're welcome.
We'll look forward to seeing you over the holiday season.
Yes, I got to come in for those cookies. Those are great.
Mary Jean, thanks so much
thank
for calling.
You bet.
Let's go now to Jack in Kansas City. Jack?
Good morning.
Good morning.
I had a question about the old gangs, the Irish gangs here in Kansas City, Missouri. Specifically, the Rabbits, run by Shannon.
Mm-hmm. Joseph Shannon.
Right. My uncle was his driver.
Huh.
Ed Connor. And evidently was his bag man as well. But my question specifically was, did the Rabbits here in Kansas City get their name from the dead rabbits in New York?
I will break in just a second here to say I was reading a little bit about that last night in a book done by Larry Larson and Nancy Holston called Pendergast, with an exclamation point after it.
Okay.
He said there are many fables and legends about how the rabbits got their name. That was the Joseph Shannon faction. You can put it a little bit, I mean, you can call it a gang, you can call it a boss rule thing, or you can call it a faction. But Joe Shannon was one of the important politicians in town. He was of Irish descent and had an Irish, a lot of Irish descendants who believed in him. The rabbits, as I understand it, some people say they were like scared rabbits when they'd go to the polls. Others say that was the goat name for them. They said when we show up, the rabbits will scatter over the hill. And it's also said the goats got their names from the rabbits, too. They were derogatory names. These things, I think it's going to be impossible to ever know for sure how the rabbits got their name. But they were an important force here until Pendergast basically became the dominant of the boss of bosses in the late 1920s.
Oh,
that's my understanding.
All right. Well, thank you.
All right, Jack. Thanks very much for your call.
Mm.
We have time here for at least one other song by Bob Reeder, and it's going so well here and so festive, I think we ought to try it. This one is called The Sons of Molly.
When the wind blows wild at night past the breakers, melancholy. You stand in the dark with your ear to the wind, you can hear the sons of Molly. And deep in the dark of the old mine shaft, you can smell the smoke and the fire. And a whisper low from the mine below is a ghost of Molly Maguire. I'm telling you boys, Mickey Doyle is my name, and I come from Carvin County. I shot the boss at the Langsford mine, and my soul is up for bounty. And I will die with my head held high. I fought for the men down below.
Bob, this is great listening to this. You're going to be performing what nights this weekend of St. Patrick's
Day? Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the O'Malley's Pub in Weston. I'll be in the upper cellar, and then we'll have an amazing amount of different bands down below, different Irish groups, We've got a great Irish musician community here in Kansas City with several great groups, and we're getting new ones all the time, and that's really wonderful. I'm also the director of the Irish Music Association that promotes Irish music worldwide. And so I try to stay ahead of all of it, basically in America as well as Europe and Ireland. So,
For those who may, those few people who may not know, Weston is in Platte County up the river. What's a good way to get there?
It's so easy. You just take I-29 north to exit 20 and you follow the signs to Weston. It's real easy. It's about a 30-minute drive from downtown Kansas City, and it may seem like it's a long way away, but it's not. And the nice thing about it is that the town is always so very cooperative with the Irish community up there. And we ask that people obey the laws when they come up there, of course. And sometimes it's good to get a good room and you know, at the end of the night on St. Patrick's Day, if you can. Most of them are all booked up, I think, right now. But we'll have a great celebration, and it'll just be the cellars there are, when you walk into those cellars, it's kind of like walking back into Ireland, even though they're made by German. Later on, a family of brothers took over the place that were Irish-English and born in Ireland, lived in England, and then came to the United States, the Danziger brothers. And then, of course, later on, after Prohibition and up to 1940, the Royal Brewing Company operated. War was coming on. They closed the corporation forever because sales were off, and manpower was short. And everybody was going to war. And then in the 60s and the 70s, the O'Malley family went up to Weston, and Barbara O'Malley, who was the matriarch of the family, was a daughter of the American Revolution, and had the choice of going to North Carolina and to her ancestral home of 1755, or going to Weston, and she chose Weston.
Yeah.
And so the O'Malley family then established even more Irish connections up there. And
you're very active in the Irish music community, or is it better to call it the Celtic music community around these parts?
Well, I hate that word, Celtic, because it really, even though it's a generalization of seven great Celtic nations, I like to differentiate between Welsh music and Irish music, mm-hmm. and, of course, Scottish music. And Brittany and stuff like that. It's something that nobody really knows if the Celts even had music. That was between the 2nd and 4th centuries. And so I don't even see a connection with it.
There are a lot of Irish festivals and a lot of Irish music being played all over Kansas City all year long.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. You guys do a heck of a job keeping that stirred up.
Thank you very much. We work pretty hard at it. Sometimes it works and the weather cooperates and we do well, and then other times, we go in a hole.
We probably have time for one more call here. Let's go to Marlene in Overland Park. Good morning, Marlene.
Hi, how are you? Years ago, I saw a movie that took place, I believe it was in Pennsylvania, about some miners called the Molly Maguires, and the last song I heard sort of made a reference to them.
That's exactly right. That's what the song is about.
Were they like the miners who wanted better conditions?
Absolutely. They fought for better conditions and better pay. One of the things that the mine owner did was he got them under his thumb by controlling their commodities, and once he did that, he had them, and they were there was an old song called "I Owe My Soul to the Company Store" that was that's exactly the way it worked. The Molly Maguires actually blew up the mine, and they were kind of remnant of a union and came together to protest. And there was a good movie with Sean Connery and yeah. Richard Harris that you speak of. Was actually accurate up until the end of the movie. That was just the very beginning. They showed three men getting hung, but in truth, 20 men hung.
Oh, my goodness.
And they hung not because of what they did. They hung because they were Mala McGuire. It was out to bust that union attitude. And so... it was quite a battle, but I think that's enough. I don't want to get into this too far. I'll get mad here in a minute.
Thank you so much. That's all the time we have for today's show. Our guests have been Carrie Brown.
Thanks very much.
All right, thank you. Our guests have been Carrie Brown, whose family has run a grocery, now Brown's Market, since 1887. Carrie, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Happy St. Patrick's Day.
And our other guest, who's calming down now, is Bob Reeder, a local musician. And he's discussed St. Patrick's events in Weston, along with things Irish now all over the world. He'll be playing in Weston all this weekend. Thanks so much, Bob, for being with us.
Monroe, thank you very much for having me here today.
And I think if we can work this out, we'll end with one of Bob's songs called Whiskey in the... Oh, never mind. We'll go out a different way. For more information on our guests and upcoming shows, visit our website, kcur.org. Our show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton. Our announcer is Kim Noble. You can listen to the program again, subscribe to our podcast, or listen to any of the previous programs on kcur.org. Tune into Central Standard on Monday as the Cash Money crew helps illuminate estate planning. Up to Date is next with Dr. Wes Crenshaw and Breakup Rules. I'm Monroe Dodd. This is Central Standard Friday, and have a great St. Patrick's Day weekend.